From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Very soon, Pennsylvanians will cast their votes in what may be the decisive Democratic primary. It's been a long time since the last one. Not much has happened beyond the usual shadow boxing commentators cling to in the dog days of a campaign. But apparently there was enough fodder for ABC newsmen Charles Gibson and George Stephanopoulos to hold what many Democrats have called the worst debate ever. Questions about Obama's pastor, his remark about bitter rural Americans, his lack of a flag pin, Clinton's claim to have braved Bosnian sniper fire. These so-called electability issues took about 45 minutes to cover in what Nielsen Media Research reported was the most watched debate of the campaign, 10.7 million people. The next morning, more than 14,000 comments had been posted on ABC News' website, mostly negative, but conservative pundits approved. Mark Jerkowitz, associate director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism, said it did yield some nuggets.
The actual news-making item that seemed to generate the most attention was the idea that Hillary Clinton did acknowledge that she thought Obama could actually beat, when pressed, could beat John McCain in the general election, because this comes after a spate of coverage that suggests that her appeal to the superdelegates has been he cannot win.
Do you think Senator Obama can do that? Can he win?
Yes, yes, yes. Now, I think that I can do a better job.
So in terms of somebody saying something that actually seemed newsworthy, that was number one. Number two was the sense that Barack was very much on the defensive, unhappy, and sort of back on his heels in this particular debate.
Well, I think there's no doubt that I can see how people were offended. It's not the first time that I've made a statement that was mangled up. It's not going to be the last.
So then do you half agree with the remarks of conservative New York Times columnist David Brooks, who said, I understand the complaints, but I thought the questions were excellent. The journalist's job is to make politicians uncomfortable, to explore evasions, contradictions, and vulnerabilities. And he went on, almost every question tonight did that. The candidates each looked foolish at times, but that's their own fault.
The idea that it's the questioner's job to make candidates feel uncomfortable might be overstating it. The idea of a good debate is to keep candidates on their toes, to not let them evade critical issues, to try and flesh out their positions. It's not their job to throw at candidates everything that they suspect the opposition party, in theory, might throw at them in a general election. So one of the weaker defenses, I think, that ABC had about some of this was the idea that we were just raising issues that the Republicans are going to raise in the fall, suggesting that you are the surrogate for the opposition party and that's one of your roles in a debate. That's a questionable sentiment on their part.
And it was even more questionable because Stephanopoulos, earlier in the day, was on a radio show with conservative pundit Sean Hannity, who told him to ask the question about William Ayers, the former member of the radical anti-Vietnam War group, the Weathermen. It seemed to come out of the blue, but it came from Sean Hannity. We have a clip of that.
The only time he's ever been asked about his association with Bill Ayers, the unrepentant terrorist from the Weather Underground, who on 9/11 of all days in the New York Times was saying, I don't regret setting bombs. I don't think we did enough. When asked about it by the Politico, David Axelrod said they have a friendly relationship and that they had done a number of speeches together and that they sat on a board together. Is that a question you might ask?
Well, I'm taking notes right now.
The idea that the question came from Sean Hannity is not outrageous. The real question is, was it a legitimate question to ask somebody about their relationship with somebody who did something 40 years ago? I would consider that one a stretch, and I think that's one of the issues that then comes out of the debate for ABC and the candidates. Based on what Barack Obama has done subsequent to the debate, it seems like his campaign feels like they will get the most traction by, frankly, making fun of the debate and suggesting that this is sort of a typical distraction from the public's business.
What about the significance of lapel accessories? When we got to the taped questions from ordinary voters, and they were selected by ABC,
yep,
they were also questions about gaffes and image, you know, Hillary's trip to Bosnia and the absence of a flag pin on Obama's lapel.
Senator Obama,
I have a question, and I want to know if you believe in the American flag. I am not questioning your patriotism, but all our servicemen, policemen, and EMS wear the flag. I want to know why you don't.
I know that these questions came out of the mouth of ordinary voters. I just find it hard to believe that they represent the mainstream.
Well, I think that's a very good point. One would have to be a little bit suspicious that ABC selected the flag pin question because it sort of fit with what they were trying to do in that overall debate and seemed to be part and parcel of too much of the tone of that debate. Had it been a question inserted in a more well-rounded debate, I don't think we'd be talking about it today.
Well, after the question was asked, Charles Gibson said, you know, it comes up again and again when we talk to voters, and as you may know, it's all over the internet.
And it's something of a theme that Senators Clinton and McCain's advisors agree could give you a major vulnerability if you're the candidate in November. How do you convince Democrats that this would not be a vulnerability?
One of the problems you have with the debate at this juncture in the campaign is there have been, 20, 21 debates between these candidates? It's an arguable proposition at this point that you need any more, period. So the pressure on ABC and on Stephanopoulos and Gibson to run a debate very late in the game that's going to make news, that's going to somehow shake up the dynamic at this 11th hour, that's kind of one of those internal journalistic pressures that can sometimes lead to bad results, and you have to sort of sense on one level that ABC went into this debate saying, what can we do that no one else has done so far?
On the other hand, fundamentally, it's about a public service, isn't it?
It is about a public service. And the context of this debate is on the eve of a very important, possibly decisive primary in this long fight. This is not a game for insiders. It's not a game of gotcha. It's not supposed to be some coded secret message to the superdelegates about electability. The goal of the debate is to educate the American public and give them as informed a choice as they can get when they go to the ballot box.
And did this debate do that?
No. It certainly didn't succeed as well as it could have. I don't think there's any doubt about that.
Mark, thank you so much.
Thanks.
Mark Jerkowitz is the Associate Director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism. And this week, another infallible headline generator.
An extravagant ceremony on the south lawn of the White House.
They greeted him like a rock star after the Pope's already very full day.
And there he is. He looked like he was smiling as he was waving. This is an exciting moment.
Amid the pomp and circumstance surrounding the papal visit this week were news reports of Benedict bobbleheads, I Heart the Pope bumper stickers, and much ado about the modified two-door Mercedes ML430, more commonly known as the Popemobile.
It's got bulletproof glass. It's a Mercedes-Benz. It's got a lot of capability there.
Of course, a visit by the spiritual leader of 1.3 billion Catholics worldwide will raise more serious issues as well.
Like the war in Iraq, like peace in the Middle East.
Pulling out of Iraq too quickly, the potential for a humanitarian crisis.
During the flight from Rome, the Pope addressed the sex abuse scandals in the Catholic Church.
Tom Roberts, news director of the National Catholic Reporter, says that the Pope can raise any of these issues if he chooses, and he does. But not because he's prompted by the media. They never get the chance.
They're dealing with a basically secret organization. It makes its decisions in secret, its appointments in secret. There's no precedent for a real, robust exchange. You don't even have that with bishops in the United States. Very often, more often than not, I would say, they choose the turf, they choose the circumstance, and they choose the questions. It's rare that they would put themselves out for an all-out, no-holds-barred news conference. So it's a tough assignment, especially when these events become the point of coverage.
Christopher Hitchens, no friend of the church, we must say, noted this week that the Pope is, after all, a head of state, and he ought to be treated as such. For example, he says, we ought to ask him why the church continues to shelter Cardinal Law, who covered up child rape in the Archdiocese of Boston. But the Pope sets the agenda, and he doesn't schedule press conferences.
There is some legitimacy to that critique. And I think there are a lot of Catholics who think that Cardinal Law was given a fine pass to a new life in the Vatican.
But will anyone get a chance to put that question to him? And further, would anybody have the guts to put the question to him?
I think people would, but it doesn't happen. I mean, on the plane ride over from Rome, the Vatican accepted questions from reporters, screened them, and then chose the ones that they would answer. It is interesting that he chose as his first question to answer the one about sex abuse, which signals that he thought it was very important, and indeed that issue has dominated the coverage for the first couple of days.
How has the press handled this story?
I think that one of the indications, for instance, of how important it is a piece on the New York Times blog by Peter Steinfels, who has been one of the more distinguished church watchers and a very measured critic, if he is critical, of church activity. And in this case, he is fairly severe, and I would even say pessimistic, because he talks about how traumatized Catholics have been by this. But I think the media has gone as far as it can go as an entity outside the Catholic community. You know, and what can it do in a papal trip? It can report on what he says, and what he's saying is that this is a very important issue. But it's tough for even those people within the community to say, okay, we understand that. We've been saying that for years, decades even. How do we get beyond it? And I don't know that without being able to directly question, without addressing that whole matter of clerical culture that allowed this crisis to develop and to sustain itself, I don't think anybody can adequately report on it. You can't get at it.
Setting that issue aside, what else has stood out for you in the coverage of the papal visit so far?
There's been some really good coverage, I think, in general of the American Catholic Church. One of the more interesting pieces I ran across was by Jennifer Medina of the New York Times, who went to a church on the Upper West Side of New York and really just allowed the people to speak for themselves. And you get the sense of the dimensions of this church, of the diversity in worship and point of view in this one place.
This is a church that welcomes gays and seems to be engaging in precisely that cafeteria Catholicism we've been hearing so much about this week.
Some of us would prefer to call it the big tent Catholicism. And we all know throughout our own dioceses and wherever you are, and however strict that the bishop may be or traditional, there are always these enclaves where there will be welcoming communities, even if they can't be real open about it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tom Roberts is the news director of National Catholic Reporter. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, published two studies detailing widespread misrepresentation and outright manipulation of medical research. One concerned the suppression of clinical results by the drug company Merck for its arthritis drug Vioxx, which has been shown to carry a higher-than-disclosed risk of heart attacks for those taking it. The second JAMA article concerned articles about Vioxx printed in medical journals, articles which carried the bylines of supposedly independent third-party authors, but which were actually the work of ghostwriters paid by Merck. This is a pharma industry practice that has been reported before, including on this program. But JAMA's editor-in-chief, Dr. Catherine D. DeAngelis, says this was the first time she really had the goods.
The reason we publish this is because this is the first time that we had enough data that people can go to and check out. And I can tell you that over the last 2 days, I've been receiving phone calls and even documents showing that this is a wide practice. People are still being paid to put their name on papers that essentially were already written.
But you have acknowledged that you personally were well aware of the ghostwriting issue years ago. And in your editorial, you suggest a list of measures that journals can take and researchers can take and the government can take to diminish the possibilities of fraud. It seemed to me to be a list that should have been institutionalized years ago.
I agree with you. Yes, I agree with you. Try and do it. I couldn't even get some of my colleagues with the wonderful journals to adopt the rule that you must have an independent, if you will, or an academic biostatistician review all the data and do the data analysis. If someone doesn't want an independent, objective person looking at their data and their analysis. Chances are they're trying to hide something, and I don't want that paper because I don't want to publish it.
And what about an affidavit of authorship where if I'm putting my name on an article, I say, yes, this is my work. It is nobody else's work. It hasn't been ghostwritten. How can it be that in 2008, that hasn't long since been the minimum requirement for putting your name atop a journal article?
We have that rule, but there are, you know, there are 15,000 journals that deal with healthcare, but they don't all have that rule. We have an authorship form that you have to sign all sorts of things. These 11 points that I put in as a beginning, many of these we do at JAMA, and some of the other big journals do it. But if everybody would adhere to these, it would be wonderful. I was at a meeting with a group of us who are trying to work with the academic medical centers and with the medical specialty societies regarding their role with pharmaceutical companies. And one of the things that looks like the medical specialty societies, I hope, will adopt is that at least their officers cannot serve on speakers' bureaus. Speakers' bureaus are one example of how the drug company, they pay you to speak, they give you the slides. You can't add or subtract any slide without the permission of the drug company. And they even have the nerve to put their logo down, usually in the left lower quadrant of the slide. And they tell you what to say about the illness and their drug. Now, they're not saying it. Their drug salesman isn't saying it. Some opinion leader is saying it. Therefore, it must be true.
Trained monkey on the take.
Well, you said that. I didn't.
One of your suggestions concerns peer reviewers, and it made my eyebrows raise, because the suggestion is that anybody who is a peer reviewer of an article submitted to a journal who then turns around and reveals the contents of the article to a drug company should be banned from reviewing and publishing articles in that journal.
Right.
But, do you know of cases where that has happened?
Yes. It was someone who was asked to review an article for the New England Journal of Medicine. This person immediately called the drug company in question and sent them a copy of the manuscript, which is absolutely supposed to be confidential.
You also say that any editor who is a party to allowing for-profit companies to manipulate his or her journal must be relieved of the editorship.
Yes, I absolutely believe that. If you knowingly allow a for-profit company to manipulate your journal, then you're going to lose your job. We're going to fire you. The practice, I hope, would stop.
What do you suppose the chances are that your recommendations will be embraced?
I don't know. All I know is that if we don't do something, patients are going to continue to get harmed. We are all going to continue to be manipulated. It is time for us to take back our profession. We gave it away, or we allowed it to be taken from us. Now let's take it back. None of this stuff could happen if we didn't cooperate. It's as simple as that.
Well, Catherine, thank you very much.
You're welcome. You take care now.
Dr. Catherine D. DeAngelis is the editor of the Journal of the American Medical Association.
Jonathan Zittrain's new book, The Future of the Internet and How to Stop It, is a clarion call to protect the freedom of the Internet
from those who would stifle it for the sake of security and reliability. Zittrain says there are two paths to the wired world of the future. One is tethered to a central brain and barricaded like the IBM mainframes of old. The other path is the unbounded internet we have now, what he calls a generative system that allows everyone to tinker and invent unimpeded. The first generative system was introduced in the late 70s by Steve Jobs, wearing his first suit at the first West Coast Computer Fair. It was basically components assembled in a molded plastic case, ungainly but convenient and yours to control with the right software. The world's first personal computer, the Apple II.
What was most amazing about this moment was that Steve did not have particular expectations of how the machine would be used and how far it would go. But then, within 2 years, two guys, Bob Frankston and Dan Bricklin, invented VisiCalc, the first spreadsheet ever.
The first computer spreadsheet.
Yes. And businesses around the world were like, wow, where have you been all our lives? And they started buying spreadsheets, which meant they had to buy Apple IIs. So Apple IIs start flying off the shelves, and Apple has no idea why. They had to do market research to figure out why their machine was so popular.
And why was it?
It was popular because totally unrelated guys to the vendors, Dan and Bob, had come up with an amazing application. And Apple was not limited to its own imagination as to what its computer could do. And now it's so commonplace that you don't even think about it. You can run software coming from anywhere in the world, written by anybody, and nobody in the middle, not the computer vendor, not the operating system vendor, even Bill Gates, the famously proprietary Bill Gates, doesn't and can't stop you.
Now, you say that the two modern emblems of generative path with the Apple II and the non-generative or ungenerative path with the iPhone both have the same progenitor, Steve Jobs.
Yes. So fast forward 30 years. Now it's 2007, and Steve Jobs is making another big technology introduction in San Francisco. And it's the gorgeous iPhone. And everybody I know who has an iPhone basically loves it. And I say it's great too. But my worry is Steve Jobs made no apology that he controls the horizontal and the vertical. He controls the phone from soup to nuts.
We don't want blank slate cell phones that have to be programmed. I want to buy it, take it out of the box, turn it on, make a call. He has a point. What's pernicious about this, even theoretically?
Problem number one is no more surprises. You don't get two guys in a garage cooking up something like the spreadsheet. Internet telephony like Skype, Kazaa, and other peer-to-peer music sharing, email. The World Wide Web itself came from a physicist who was goofing around. So to lose that ability to be able to cook up something and send it around and see whether it works, that would be a terrible loss. That's one thing. The other thing is that devices like the iPhone, whether they are as in their first version, what I call sterile, just Steve Jobs gets to change them, or even in their second version, what I call contingently generative, third parties now can write code for the iPhone, but Steve Jobs still gets to approve it or yank it if he doesn't like it. That makes these things very controllable by regulators who go through people like Steve Jobs to do it. And I can give you an example of that. TiVo sued EchoStar not long ago for patent infringement. They said that EchoStar made a digital video recorder that was too much like a TiVo. They won, and EchoStar owes them $90 million. But then they asked for something more. They got an order from the judge that said within 30 days, EchoStar had to fry by a remote upgrade. All but a handful of the EchoStar DVRs already sold and placed in living rooms around the world.
What?
That's it. You wake up, your EchoStar becomes an Echo brick. And then I start to think about this by analogy. Imagine coming down to the kitchen to find that your toaster has enjoyed the winter update, and now it has a third slot. And, you know, all right, I guess I could use that third slot to make a little more toast now. But it's a little puzzling to realize that you didn't buy an object and now it's yours. You bought a continuing service from a vendor that can be influenced by outsiders as well as its own whims.
On the other hand, something that some outside source can provide is security, both personal and national. We've all seen the Hollywood scenarios about banks collapsing or planes colliding or identities disappearing because of evildoers who are armed with viruses and worms. And it's because it's an open system that we have worms. Generative systems are hazardous.
This is what makes the needle pretty difficult to thread. It would be a shorter book, if what I could say is, you can have my PC when you pry it from my cold, dead hands. And come on, everybody, join me. Even though it doesn't work so well at times, hang on to it because it's worth it. But I don't want people to have to face a dichotomy between an open PC that has the benefit of running code from anywhere, which is why we like it, but the curse of running code from anywhere, which is why it can be so easily subverted on the one hand, or a sterile or contingently generative appliance or service like the iPhone or the Facebook application system on the other. And what I propose in the book are ways to try to blunt the sharpest edges of the open PC and of the open internet so that we can preserve the features that matter most, what I call the generative features.
In fact, you say that we need a latter-day Manhattan Project, not to build the bomb, but to design the tools and conventions by which to continually defuse one.
I'm part of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School and the Oxford Internet Institute at Oxford University. And together, these research programs have started something called Stop Badware, which is meant to be an initiative, a .org, that can help take on some of the problems of bad code and try to thread that needle of how to solve the problem of systems that are too open without having to close them down. And there's a website out there that is perfectly safe now, I should alert you, but for a time was not, called chuckroast.com. You can go to Chuck Roast, buy a jacket. It turns out, though, that for a while, the Chuck Roast site had been hacked, unbeknownst to Chuck Henderson, who runs Chuck Roast. People visiting the site with the wrong browser would come away with their computer completely compromised by the anonymous attacker. And for sites like this, there hasn't been anybody to own security. You try to tell even a well-meaning webmaster, hey, did you realize your site's been hacked and aside from selling your product, it's distributing viruses? They don't know how to process that. Their answer is, whatever, would you like to buy a fleece? And we worked with Google, we still do, such that Google sends a robot out to crawl the web as an innocent browser waiting to be hijacked. And it encounters a site like Chuck Roast. Chuck Roast tries to hijack it, and Google notes that and gives that data to us. And that way, we can then note what websites are dangerous out there, and Google notes it on its search results. There's actually an extra note on it that says, warning, this site may harm your computer. Don't go there. And as you might guess, that greatly affects the flow of traffic to websites, and suddenly they have every incentive in the world to clean up.
And this is the Stop Badware program.
Correct.
Do you guys wear badges?
Well, I'm tempted to say we don't need no stinking badges, but I think better the idea is to have a lot of people be able to pick up a badge on their way in. You wear it and you realize that maybe, for instance, if you're Chuck Roast and you've been hacked, maybe some people can help you on condition that you'll help the next set of people that get hacked and pay it forward.
And this is what concerns me. I mean, at the beginning of your book, you make reference to the fact that a lot of the people who conceived and helped build the internet were very naive about the sorts of people who would use it and how people could be made into good netizens. Well, you know, all these years later, you're back at square one. You're still relying on netizenship. Most people are like me. They don't have a great instinct for machines. You have to contend with a population of internet users yelling for simplicity above all else. And doesn't that mean that your cause is lost?
Doesn't mean the cause is lost. The ideas I have include, for example, being willing to download a little piece of software to your machine that reports its vital signs back to the rest of the herd, to the other people using their machines similarly. And with it, you can relay when there's software that's not working so well and when it's working better, even if you're a novice. You don't have to be a geek to make this work. Ultimately, having a social dimension to the computing and the networking that we're doing, realizing that it's an act of collective hallucination that's gotten us this far, and it requires help from all of us to maintain.
Like democracy.
Like democracy itself, exactly. And in that sense, it is sort of a constitutional moment.
I think it's a question of competing stakes. I mean, you are saying that the most important thing is to preserve innovation. On the other hand, the internet also controls our records, our identities. These things are too important to be compromised even for a moment.
It's true. And my thought is there are actually a couple rabbits still to be pulled out of the hat that might buy us some time. A guy named Butler Lampson at Microsoft Research came up with the idea of a red machine and a green machine, virtual machines inside one PC. It's basically like two-wheel drive and four-wheel drive on your vehicle. And there's a way to take your PC off-roading. So you've got your spreadsheets and your financial data and your term papers in the green zone. And then you can go off-roading and load up that bizarre program. You know, I want to see the hamster dance. It's such a tantalizing program. But then you run it and maybe it eats the hard drive. But luckily, it stays in the red zone. And you have a special button that basically just wipes clean the red zone and starts it again. That's a way maybe of preserving the experimentalist spirit that's gotten us so far while also conceding that so much of what we do is now mission critical. So there are some ideas discussed in the book of that flavor that try to make it so that non-technical people as much as possible can still meaningfully use technologies that let them experiment without the experiment blowing up in their faces.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks so much, Brooke.
Jonathan Zittrain is the professor of Internet, Governance, and Regulation at Oxford University and co-founder of Harvard Law School's Berkman Center for Internet and Society. The new book is called The Future of the Internet and How to Stop It.
Coming up, politics, bloodshed, self-censorship, reconciliation. Free speech and the culture clash between East and West.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world, the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. A couple of weeks ago, Bob's interview with a Canadian Muslim woman named Naseem Mithwani sparked a heated exchange of comments at onthemedia.org. Bob and Mithwani talked about her decision to file a human rights claim against Canada's Maclean's magazine. She took that action in response to an article she and three other Canadian Muslim students found hateful and contemptuous toward Muslims. Bob asked her if she worried that the Muslim community would be seen as intolerant of free speech.
It's sort of a catch-22. When Muslims feel aggrieved and they resort to tactics such as violence, we criticize it, rightfully so. When Muslims in the West try to use civilized legal recourse, we are also told that somehow this is incompatible with Western values. And to me, that's incomprehensible. I don't understand what we can do.
Her remarks prompted us to consider the context that underlies this tug of war over press freedom, the so-called clash of cultures between some Muslims living in the West and their host nations. Nowhere has this clash played out more fiercely than in Europe, where free expression has caused offense so profound it has exploded into violence. Should all speech, including insults to religion and race, be protected? And when the media consider what they should and shouldn't say, what's the line between cultural sensitivity and self-censorship? The answers to those questions keep evolving, as Bob found when he asked some of the people who stand at the center of that storm.
3 weeks ago, right-wing Dutch politician Geert Wilders released his short film Fitna, titled with the ambiguous Arabic word that can mean schism or provocation. Nothing ambiguous about the movie, though. It shows graphic images of horrific acts of terrorism, from the Twin Towers to corpse desecration to beheadings, juxtaposed with the Quranic verses that supposedly justify the violence. And for good measure, Wilders throws in video of various radical clerics inciting jihad against the West. The film was released on the video website LiveLeak.com. The next day, it was taken down after threats to LiveLeak personnel until security could be put in place to protect them. But how eerily the episode seemed to fulfill Wilders' bleak and alarming vision. a Muslim subculture that spawns barbaric reactions to free expression, and a craven, ultimately self-defeating Western self-censorship. Yes, Wilders, the Islamophobic provocateur, has neatly identified the fitna in two cultures. There is the growing and largely unassimilated Dutch Muslim population, but also Europe at large, taught by history to flinch at the very thought of stereotyping. Mein Kampf, Holocaust denial, and other anti-Semitic propaganda are outlawed in much of Western Europe, where the backlash of colonialism and fascism has elevated respect for alien cultures to an article of faith. Dutch-born journalist Ian Baruma.
That was quite common amongst the sort of liberal left, was to denounce anybody who even saw a large number of Muslim immigrants coming into the country as a problem. Such people were very quickly denounced as racists, as people who were going to reintroduce the kind of racism that the Nazis had.
The problem, says Baruma, is that the impulse to stifle hateful speech also stifles healthy debate about social and political conflicts that desperately need to be discussed. And if the liberal orthodoxy is disinclined, who will dominate the conversation? Voices like Wilders, opportunists, xenophobes, and reactionaries just itching to confront the taboos of the left.
They are tapping into a common anxiety amongst people that the country no longer belongs to them, that they're being abandoned by the political elite. And this anxiety has been crystallized by a general fear of immigrants and Muslims in particular.
For example, in 2004, pugnacious filmmaker Theo van Gogh released a 10-minute drama called Submission, the story of four Muslim women. One is a pious young newlywed in an arranged marriage, beaten by her husband and raped by her uncle.
And when I told my mother, she said she would take it up with my father, but my father ordered her and me not to question his brother's honor. I experience pain each time my uncle comes to see me. I feel caged like an animal waiting for slaughter, and I'm filled with guilt and shame, and I feel abandoned.
The film created an uproar in Holland for its damning portrayal of Islam, but especially for the Quranic verses painted on the bare skin of the actress. This blasphemy was too much for a disaffected young Moroccan immigrant named Mohamed Bouyeri, who in November 2004 confronted Van Gogh on an Amsterdam street and shot him to death. He then used a dagger to pin an angry screed to Van Gogh's body. It called for a holy war against the West and specifically targeted the film's writer, former Dutch parliamentarian Ayaan Hirsi Ali. The Somali-born refugee-turned MP is herself a harsh critic of Muslim law and culture, but in the murder of her colleague, she also casts blame on the folly of what she calls white guilt.
Mohamed Bouyeri, the man who killed Theo van Gogh, would not have done that and could not have done that if in the 1970s, the 1980s, when Dutch authorities saw the emergence of radical Islam within Europe, within their own country, they had taken the necessary measures, which they didn't.
She accuses the powers that be, in other words, of submission to radical intimidation and their own conflicted liberalism.
We can't try to silence dissident opinion. We have to argue and we have to engage with each other. And we can't do that by threatening to take people to court, by killing them, or by ostracizing those who disagree with us.
Such sentiment was entirely the point behind the publication in 2005 of the notorious Danish cartoons, which included hideous caricatures of the Prophet Muhammad, including one portraying him as a terrorist bomber. The 12 panels were commissioned by the newspaper Jyllands Posten after the author of a children's book on Islam was unable to find an illustrator, lest graven images of the prophet be deemed blasphemous. The cartoons were intended to satirize Danish self-censorship, but to much of the Muslim world, they were a grave, graven insult, which is not necessarily a rejection of free expression. At some point, even protected speech is so disrespectful as to be beyond the pale. Think, for example, of the N-word. Mustafa Chendid is a Copenhagen imam who attempted to win apologies from the newspaper and from the Danish government for the offense.
Muhammad, for me, is better than myself, my family, than my parents, better than anything. So if you discuss his message, it's fine. You criticize him, it's fine. You insult him, it's not fine.
After weeks went by and no official apologies were forthcoming, Chendid's Islamic Society of Denmark sought help in Cairo, where the government found it politically useful to take up the grievance. From Egyptian state newspapers, word spread all around the world, leading to mass demonstrations, riots, torched embassies, scores of deaths. This demonstration was not in Cairo or Islamabad or Jakarta, but in London's Hyde Park. Kill, kill Denmark, bin Laden's coming back. Westerners found it absurd and medieval that mere words and pictures would be deemed justification for violence. They wondered why millions of Muslims could be so furious about a disrespectful cartoon, yet fail to rally in outrage at the slaughter of innocents by terrorists acting in Islam's name. And they worried, at last aloud, if liberal notions of tolerance had allowed respect for alien values to undermine their own. Provocation. Schism. In Copenhagen, the mecca of multiculturalism, fitna.
The multiculturalist model has failed in Europe, and it's becoming pretty clear now. We have to come up with something else.
Flemming Rose, culture editor for Denmark's Jyllands-Posten, and the man who commissioned the Danish cartoons.
There is a misunderstanding of what tolerance means. The fact of the matter that today the concept of tolerance are being used in order to stifle free speech.
But of course, not entirely. While media and political elites may not feel free to share their most uncharitable thoughts, obviously some voices are stifled not at all. Not Geert Wilders and not radical Islamists who freely float bizarre conspiracy theories, spew hatred, and incite violence online. In the 21st century, for the first time in human history, there is an unfettered and instantaneous free market for paranoia on the web.
Media has played a big role in this democratization of fatwas, if you will.
Lawrence Pintak is director of the Kamal Adham Center for Journalism Training and Research at the American University in Cairo.
Everybody and his brother has a TV station or a website, and everybody and his brother are issuing fatwas. And I may have no credentials Islamically, but if I've set myself up as a cleric, and if I can convince a small group of people around me to follow me, and then set up a website and influence others, I have a big impact, which is something that Islam as a whole is struggling to figure out how to deal with.
Struggling indeed. Consider Ibrahim al-Hudaybi of ikhwanweb.com, the English-language website of the Muslim Brotherhood. He has been a moderate voice preaching calm in the wake of Geert Wilders' film Fitna. He is quick to denounce violence under any circumstances, though he's prepared to acknowledge he understands it.
If you're asking for why, it is most probably because most of the Muslim world is living under repressive regimes who do not allow for the freedom of expression. So we are not familiar with the idea of discussing things and disagreeing and being able to present our ideas in a civilized manner.
Hudaybi, like Danish Imam Chendid, takes pains to distinguish between free speech and insults, which he says are inexcusable. This prompts me to inquire about a double standard. What of the insults routinely hurled by Muslim clerics, politicians, and mobs towards Christians and Jews? What does he think, for instance, of Palestinian schoolchildren being taught that Jews are apes and pigs? Hudaybi's response is to differentiate between insult and expression of legitimate grievances.
Let me start by asserting that I am against any form of insults. But not every criticism against what's going on in Palestine, in Palestinian territories, or what's going on in Iraq is an insult to Americans. If you kill somebody and he responds by criticizing what you do, criticizing illegal occupation of those who are occupied and not of Americans in general, of those who are killing civilian women and children and old men in Palestine and Palestinian territories, and not of every Jew, that's a different story.
And there it is, a sense of righteousness born of a sense of victimization that purports to explain, if not exactly excuse, the radical minority of Muslims. So it's not merely different cultures and different values that separate some immigrants from their native European neighbors. It is also the fixation on obtaining justice from a Western world that conspires to diminish them or worse. To Ayaan Hirsi Ali, who was forced by death threats to flee Holland and live in hiding, that difference spells trouble.
These critical questions of Islam will forever be asked as long as the Quran is used as a justification for killing people, and as long as the so-called mainstream people remain silent and refuse to distance themselves from that violence.
A conflict forever? Modernism versus primitivism? Cultural relativism versus self-preservation? Is it really so simple and so hopeless? What if, for instance, the horror stories and headlines were obscuring a slow but steady process of assimilation? Author Ian Baruma's Murder in Amsterdam attempts to unravel the complexities behind Theo van Gogh's assassination. He says the doomsayers are missing something.
They assume that the third generation will be exactly the same as the first generation, which is, of course, never true. As people move into the middle class, they often become much less religious. They change, they assimilate.
The population of the Muslim world is enormous, something like 1.2 billion Muslims.
Professor Munir Farid is Secretary General of the Islamic Society of North America.
And many of them, especially those who live in impoverished parts of the world, look forward to gaining access. They want some of that which is Western. They're not too enthused by the culture, I admit, but they want the material trappings that Europe offers. They want the education that Europe offers. And guess what? They want the freedom that Europe offers. And in time, they get acculturated.
It's certainly true that ghettoized, marginalized, first-generation immigrants tend naturally to turn inward. Think of Chinatown and Little Italy and the Yiddish-speaking enclaves of Manhattan's Lower East Side. They had their own customs, their native languages, their own newspapers, and high birth rates. But they did not hijack America. Contrary to some alarmist predictions of cultural takeover, Farid says, Muslims do not represent a demographic Trojan horse bent on overpowering Western societies. Rather, he says, they're just fish out of water.
It's a very difficult thing to reconfigure your culture and your faith in a new environment. It takes a long while. This is a learning curve, and Muslims are indeed learning how to deal maturely with issues that are offensive to them.
And perhaps the learning curve is especially steep because of the societies they are coming from. Repressive ones, certainly throughout the Arab world, tribal ones, ancient and patriarchal, impoverished ones, rife with illiteracy and despair. Yet even Ayaan Hirsi Ali, after all she has been through, is at least guardedly optimistic.
Because enough people are waking up to the danger. There are lots of people who want to listen. There are lots of people who want to think about how to bring about that assimilation.
It's worth noting that her film, Submission, spawned the director's murder, but 4 years later, 3 weeks after the release of Fitna, no such violence has erupted. In Holland, so far, Geert Wilders' provocateur has provoked only discussion. And what about Denmark, where Flemming Rose of Jyllands-Posten still struggles in his own personal Fitna, about whether he did the right thing?
If I say, well, I will do it again tomorrow, a lot of people will find me cold-hearted and pretty cynical. But if I say, well, I will not do it again, then I will send a very unfortunate message to those who have intimidated, threatened, and committed violence during the Khartoum crisis and tell them, if you threaten enough, if you are intimidating enough, we will do exactly as you please.
A dilemma, yes, but one apparently resolved. In February, his was one of 17 Danish newspapers to reprint the cartoons on the same day, knowing full well how offensive the images are to so many.
This time around, there were no news value in reprinting that cartoon, and that it more had to do with solidarity with this cartoonist who had to go into hiding because, in fact, three people were plotting to kill him. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that in Denmark, over the last 2 years, it has become non-controversial to publish that cartoon. In fact, we have published that cartoon maybe 10 or 20 times without any reaction whatsoever.
No riots, no murders, no fatwas, no embassies aflame. Instead, shaking heads, a few shrugs, and resignation. which, by the way, is not the same thing as submission. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Jason Isaac and Zach Marsh. We also had help from Nadia Zonis and Sasha Evans. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC. This is NPR.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.